Good day and welcome to the RIIO-ED1 FloTrac Final Determinations conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Maxime Frerk. Please go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for joining our call on the RIIO-ED1 final determinations that we've put out this morning. I know they went out first thing this morning, and so many of you will have had a chance to have at least a brief look at what's there. And I know there have been a few calls and discussions with the team here, but I thought it was worth me at least going over some of the headline messages just for those of you that haven't had a chance to absorb, because I know there's been a lot going on today. So to kick off with really just a reminder of where we are in the process. As I said a moment ago, this is our final determinations for the FloTrac companies, having kind of finished our determinations on WPD a while ago. So this is our final decision, but we will be publishing the license changes that implement that decision for statutory consultation in December. And then we will take a decision on those license changes, the actual wording of the license drafting in February. And the companies then have an appeal window after that if they're not happy with our decision and want to refer that to the Competition and Markets Authority. So that means the appeal window runs through to March, and the new regime hopefully then comes into effect from the 1st of April. It's worth just reminding you that the way the regime works, the year one revenues were actually settled at draft determination stage. So the figures that we published back in July will set the year one revenues. The reason for that is so that that gives more notice for the suppliers to know broadly what's going to be happening in terms of levels of charging so that they can think about that and factoring that into their pricing. Insofar as there is a difference between what we set out in July and what we have here for year one, that difference is then recovered over the whole period. So that's the kind of administrative side of it and where we are in terms of process. In terms of the substance of our decision, I think the message is pretty similar to where we were at draft determinations. That was always intended to be a part of the RIIO process, but this is not a long negotiation. This is us setting out our decisions at draft determination, listening to representations and any kind of factual information that we may have presented to us, and then reaching our final determination off the back of that. So relatively limited change. Specifically on the financing side of things, there's really no change. The cost of capital is unchanged from draft determinations. So cost of equity of 6% and cost of debt, we are sticking with the trombone of the iBoxx index, so 10- to 20-year trombone, notional gearing staying at 65%. There have been some changes on capitalization rates. So ENW's capitalization rate at their request was changed from 72% to 68%. And then also for SSE Hydro, which links to the Shetland issues, which I might come back to at the end because that's a kind of a slight complication to the determination that I know has prompted a few questions. So headline terms, financing side unchanged. On the TOTEX, again, sort of a relatively small difference compared to the overall level from draft determination, and inevitably some differences between the different DNOs. Worth remembering that a lot of what we do in terms of setting efficient costs is a comparative benchmarking exercise, so there's almost an inevitability that if we get some representations that persuade us that one company is sort of we've underrepresented their costs, that's going to flow through to how we judge the comparative efficiency of all of the others. So a strong sense that where we have obviously responded to comments from all of the companies and made changes, we've made a lot of detailed changes to our underlying models, but the net effect can be very small because at the end of the day we then carry out comparative benchmarking and the efficiency frontier kind of moves as we get more evidence of companies becoming more efficient. So net effect, a fairly small change. So some change on that comparative cost benchmarking. On the real price effects, we have updated our analysis to take account of the most recent figures that we have on real wage effects and other indices, which has put a bit more money back in, but not a huge amount. And similarly on smart grids, we've had a lot of information from the companies about the concept that there was a lot more in their plans, embedded in their plans in terms of what they were delivering on smart grids. And what we've done there is rather fuller analysis looking at sort of the individual ways in which that those smart grid benefits can be achieved based on that improved information from the companies. As a result, our smart grid stretch that we're applying has reduced slightly, and we're clearer that there is a larger level of, if you like, smart grid savings that are already embedded in the plans. But a bit like on cost assessment, now that we understand more what can be achieved by some of the companies, we've been able to set more stretching targets for others. So the net effect of that is relatively small. So overall, on the various elements that go into TOTEX, we're increasing TOTEX by 0.8% from draft determinations. So some movement, much more robust analysis underpinning it based on the feedback we've had from the companies, and a slight increase in the level of TOTEX, which obviously then flows through into the revenues that the companies get. So I think that's the main thing. I think it's worth perhaps just coming back briefly. I mentioned the Shetlands point. In terms of the kind of context and explanation for what that issue is, obviously Shetlands as an island has its own generation. We've been looking for some time to how to that generating capacity needs complete replacement and a new energy system put in there, which SSE are responsible for doing as a distribution network covering that area. They have got to keep the existing regime running for what it looks like a 4-year period, and what we have been consulting on slightly separately from the RIIO process, but the numbers now folded in, is what we do in terms of allowances for that. Previously it was a complete pass-through. Going forward, we've got some elements of those costs are now going to be subject to the kind of efficiency incentive mechanism that applies to TOTEX overall. So it gets included in the TOTEX. But because of that, counting in TOTEX would normally mean that it just got turned into a mix of fast and slow money. This is all about keeping the system running for the next 4 years, so it's appropriate that current consumers pay, not that it gets spread over current and future consumers. So the way we've compensated for that is to adjust the capitalisation ratio for the next 4 years in order to kind of turn that Shetland money into all being fast money and paid for by current consumers. That's the kind of context behind it. Very happy to, if people want to understand a bit more about the numbers, then my colleagues here can talk through that. But that kind of is as now being folded into the main Rio price control, having been consulted on separately. So I think those are the kind of messages I wanted to give. This is our final decision. It's a small change from draft determinations, but I think something that makes our analysis more robust. I'm very happy now to hand over and open the line up for questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press the star or asterisk key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone. Please ensure that the mute function on your phone is switched off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question. And we will now take our first question from Jamie Tunnicliffe, Redburn. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. Two questions. One is just on comparative efficiency. Could you just confirm, it seems like SSE has moved up the league table. Is it sort of number two now? And just, you know, what was behind that? You mentioned a number of changes you made in your approach, and I think your document talks about some mistakes, but I'm just trying to understand that properly. And is that then this driver of the extra 15 million of revenue that they seem to get in terms of the ex ante reward from final versus draft? And then the other question is just on this point about the TOTEX numbers you show and what the financial model shows for SSE, which I have talked to your team about, but I think they were going to help with sort of reconciling it, because in the end, the numbers in the financial model are about 80-odd million higher on TOTEX than you show on your table on that slide 5. And could you just help me understand the reconciliation? Say, I presume it's partly maybe the Shetlands. I don't know if there's pensions in there, but why should I be excluding that 77 million? And why have you, when you're doing a comparison between the final and the draft, because obviously the numbers from the financial model are higher. Thank you.
Fine. So first of all, just to say on SSE, on the comparative efficiency, I mean, yes, they have improved, relatively speaking. It's quite hard in terms of the comparative cost assessment to kind of pull out any one factor, because it's, we are down looking at, our toolbox of top-down models, bottom-up disaggregated models, and a number of different changes that have been made to those that make it very hard to pull out a single factor that has shifted it. In broad terms, they've improved overall on smart grids and RPs, and they are fairly similar in terms of where they were on their cost assessment. In some sense, most of the gain has been on smart grids and RPEs. Otherwise it's sort of hard to delve into what's happening on the cost assessment side itself. But perhaps I hand over now also to colleague Ian. Sorry, I should have introduced two of us sitting in the room on the call, Ian Rowson, who can talk a little bit more about the reconciliation with the numbers in the model.
Yes, thank you. It's Ian Rowson here, Associate Partner of Regulatory Finance. The figures in the chapter on cost assessment relate to our cost assessment of the distribution activities. There are three items which lie outside of that, but they are treated as part of TOTEX to ensure that they're part of the same incentive regime. Those three, the first is the Shetland costs associated with which are more about generation than they are distribution. We also have adjustments which relate to license arrangements which treat what we call value-added services, which are services which can be provided to third parties using network assets such as broadband carriers. Those revenues anticipated for those activities are effectively taken off TOTEX, as are anticipated proceeds from disposals of assets. So just to give you the numbers, at an aggregate level, we've got 17,455 for the cost assessment figures. We've got an 86 million coming off, being added in respect of Shetland. And that's the Shetland generation costs that we've included in TOTEX. We have 16 odd million across the slow track companies coming off for net value added services, and 13 million coming up for disposals. You have that lot all together, and you get the 17,512 that we've got in the models. That is the reconciliation. Sure, if you've got any questions, let us know.
Okay, and the next question?
I get 77 million difference. Obviously, that will be composed of 86 for Shetland then, because that's obviously just an SSE, and then the difference then is that value add and disposal. It'll be a net impact of that, bringing it back down to 77. Is that right?
That's right. In broad terms, you've got the 86 for Shetland for taking it for S, and all of that is SSE, not surprisingly. Of the 16 million for net value added services, there's three of that is SSE, and of the disposals we've got seven.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
In round terms, with roundings, that brings you down to the 77.
Yes. Thank you very much.
We will now take our next question from Mark Freshney, Credit Suisse. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. Could I please ask a question on financeability? The ROEs, since you did the last round of RIIO price controls, the ROEs have come down from around about 7 to 6. But you know, you've stuck by the trombone index, which basically smooths the drop in the cost of debt allowances. Does that say that you've pretty much reduced returns to such a level that you're struggling to kind of reach financeability thresholds? So that's my first question. And just secondly, is there potential for you either at National Grid's mid-period price control or maybe in 2021 to transfer the 20-year rolling average trombone index to them, because clearly there'd be difficulties, potentially steps up in returns in 2021 if they also got the 20-year moving average.
So, I mean, I might pass over in a minute, but my headline response to that is, so we have obviously looked very carefully at questions of financeability, cost of equity we set out, and the trombone we are confident is a fair return cost of capital, and we've looked hard at financeability, taking account of actual debt costs, taking account of a range of different measures, and we were confident at draft determinations. We've listened to the representations we've had, and we remain confident that there is not a financeability issue. In terms of National Grid, we've again always been clear we're not going to reopen any of those existing price controls to look at changes to the cost of capital. Clearly, when we come to the end of the current price control and are looking to set the OT2, then we will do what we have said at the beginning in our RIIO handbook, which is we are committed to using an index, and we will check that index is appropriate in terms of covering providing a reasonable estimate and reasonable cover for the company's cost of debt. So we will repeat that exercise at the beginning of T2 in terms of deciding what's the right index or the right length of index to use for National Grid going forward, but we will not be doing anything before that. Is there anything you want to add on that, Ian?
Well, certainly to reiterate the point, yeah, there's going to be no mid-period review of the cost of debt index for National Grid. I'm sure it would be very nice if National Grid if there was, but that's not within the structure at all. On financeability, I wasn't quite clear what was behind your question in terms of not being able to being constrained by, well, the sense I had was that we were constrained by financeability issues because we have come down compared with DPCR5 on the cost of equity. Our assessment of financeability is a holistic one which considers the broad range of factors which rating agencies also consider. We have used the rating agencies, the approach that rating agencies take to to their credit ratings as a key component of our analysis. Our assessment was that the companies are fine on financeability. We've invited ENW to make some adjustments to propose adjustments to their capitalization rate to ensure that they were fully resilient to potential for downsides. The basic assessment of financeability was positive. Our assessment on the cost of capital was that the cost of capital was the right cost of capital.
Okay.
Thank you.
We will now take our next question from Deepa Venkat from Bernstein. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. I had two questions. One is on the Shetlands. I just wanted to clarify that the amount was 86 million because I think in a previous conversation I understood it was 30 million. And my second question was on the losses incentive of the current price control. You know, you have a sum in your financial model which talks of legacy losses. Is that to do with recoverability of current losses incentives, or is this something separate? And if you could just update on when the losses incentive revenues would be paid to the DNOs. Thank you.
The legacy losses amounts, so the amounts that arose from the decision that we made earlier this year, that is, so the amounts are set out in that decision. In terms of the timing of those amounts, that's set out in that decision, we've reflected that in the models, and it forms part of the overall base revenue requirement. I'm afraid I'm not quite sure where your different figure for Shetlands would come from.
So to just clarify, so on Shetlands, basically from the draft to now, there's 86 million that's basically been taken out from pass through and added to TOTEX, and that is it.
Right. Okay. Because with the for the final determinations, effectively, we've reevaluated the Shetland costs in their entirety. So it's not just a straight transfer from what we had as pass through draft determination. We've got better information on the issues there.
Okay. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We will now take our next question from Dominic Nash, Macquarie. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, good afternoon. A couple of questions, please. I think at the draft determinations, you were making quite a big steer that you thought the cost of equity could be reduced between the draft and the final. If it's possible, you give us a colour as to how your internal debate went as to whether it should have been reduced or not, and why you decided to keep it is. Secondly, sort of following on from sort of Mark's question on financeability, obviously there's a whole number of ranges you said there were, but in particular, I think the one that regulated utilities struggle with is FFO net debt. Do you have a sort of guideline on where you think the FFO net debt sort of outturning on these distribution companies going forward? And then sort of finally one, which isn't to do with this, but I guess it's to Drax. You obviously gave Drax a fine this morning. Is it possible to give us a sort of an update as to what the methodology was and behind it, and is this a signal that going forward fines are going to be significantly larger than they have been historically, please?
So on the first point, I don't think we gave any steer at draft determinations that the cost of equity could be reduced. Ofwatch did, but I don't think we were saying that at all. I think we were clear what we put out at draft determinations was our proposal and where we expected to land, and that is where we have landed. On FFO net debt...
FFO net debt, you may also be talking about water companies. We... generally speaking, are fairly solid on FFO to net debt, and that in part is a function of the fact that we have historically had relatively low depreciation rates of 20 years, so our FFO rates are relatively high relative to net debt. I think that I don't know, Maxine, do you want to mention?
And so just on Drax, I mean, clearly we're not here to try and talk much about Drax, if at all. But, you know, I mean, in broad terms, our aim in setting the penalties is to make sure that the companies are not profiting from their failure to deliver on their obligations. There is more detail on the website where we've got a penalty notice that sets out more of the calculations, but that's really all I want to say at this point.
Okay, thanks. I'll cut out the text from the draft and send over to you about the cost of equity, where you did write that it was under review. That you definitely were talking that in the draft. So, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We will now take our next question from Emily Gisui, Standard Chartered. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, may I please ask, because I see the final determination for UK Power Network is £6,029, but may I get the number for the previous final determinations and what was the actual toll tax?
Sorry, I'm not sure we have quite the number.
Yeah,
what do you mean by the previous? Do you mean our draft figures?
Not the draft, like the previous years. Like
okay.
Pre-
can I make a suggestion, because we won't probably have those numbers to hand. Can I suggest you contact us offline?
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Again, as a reminder, if you want to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. We now have a follow-up question from Jamie Tunnicliffe, Redburn. Please go ahead, your line is open.
Hello again. It looked like the efficiency incentive rate for SSE went up slightly, I think, from 55 to 56. Can you just explain what was behind that and whether that was a sort of company-specific thing, or whether there were changes for other companies as well, and sort of what was behind it. Thank you.
So the efficiency incentive rate is part of the overall, what we call the IQI, the Information Quality Incentive Regime, which is quite a complex matrix and is fairly... So the level of efficiency incentive they get is linked to... how efficient their overall business plan is viewed as being, and so the fact that they've, as we noted earlier, they've moved slightly up the efficiency sort of ranking list means that they are now kind of, their efficiency incentive rate adjusts very slightly as well. Other companies will have changed either up or down, depending where they score on their overall efficiency ratio, as set out in the kind of details in the IQI section of the document.
Thank you.
As a reminder again, please press *1 if you want to ask a question. We will now take our next question from Orlando Finzi, MNG Investments. Please go ahead, your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to pick up on the financeability. I guess I'm trying to probe to get a bit more colour from you. Obviously, you stuck to your notion that the post-maintenance interest coverage ratio isn't a valid ratio, even though that's the one that the cash flow ratio a lot of agencies or Moody's particularly focus on. But also, in terms of FFO to net debt questions, you're sort of saying they're comfortable with financeability. I just want to, I guess, kind of find out from you what rating you're assuming for financeability. I presume you're using a mid triple B type rating. It'd be nice if you could give a little more clarity, because it does seem to be the bit of this price control review that's a sort of substantial shift apart from the introduction of Rio, substantial shift versus past price control reviews. And I guess there is the risk of sector-wide downgrades, or at least for a number of companies within the sector, i.e. make the whole sector effectively triple B rated going forwards. But any clarity you can provide would be great.
Sorry, but I will just start by saying, so when we look at the metrics, we're not dismissing PMIC. We are looking at a full range of metrics, and we are looking to maintain them at a investment grade credit rating. But I might let Ian kind of fill in a bit more.
Yeah. No, we do not believe PMICR is invalid. We recognise that the rating agencies use PMICR, and we've made it really clear that we have given full weight to the PMICR and our analysis of their the financeability issues. However, we have highlighted that there are dynamics within the PMICR which have caused us to reflect, and that has led us to add to our portfolio of credit metrics with the development of our resilience metric, which we've called PMICRG. It's an evolution from PMICR, but it's not intended to replace PMICR. It's just another component. We don't see any one particular metric as being predominant, and neither do the rating agencies. The approach we've taken, we think, is in broad terms conceptually, but also in very practical terms, very consistent with the rating agency's own assessments. And in terms of where we see the ratings, we're not per se targeting a rating. We have set our cost of debt on the basis of somewhere between a triple B and a single A. We believe that that is reasonable over the course of Rio ED1. And there are, I think, in terms of understanding the underlying risk profile of those businesses, I think that's our judgment. But certainly in terms of considering whether there is a prospect of companies losing investment grade, we've considered that very seriously, and we are confident that there is no realistic prospect of that happening.
And could I just follow on there? Obviously, investment grade is a very broad term, and there's everything from what is a safe territory with a single A rating, and arguably probably appropriate for this part of the industry in the medium term, through to triple B, which goes right from a relatively safe triple B plus down to triple B minus, and on the border high yield. When you say investment grade, It's a very nebulous term. You must be taking, I appreciate your saying somewhere between a triple B and a single A for cost of debt. But can you give any colour on, do you see a flaw when you're working with this as triple B flat, in terms of being comfortable with investment grade, or how are you quantifying your comfort?
Okay. I think we see the investment grade is clearly anything effectively above triple B minus, but that's we would obviously be rather concerned if we're seeing companies sitting at triple B minus. However, I don't think that's in prospect. There's a raft of different reasons why a company should be able to protect itself from that, in terms of ensuring that it has an efficient cost of debt going forward. We see real scope for a better understanding of the risk profile of these businesses. There is obviously always scope for companies to, if they are in any financial tension, we look to companies and their owners to ensure that they have an appropriate financial structure. So we are not, we don't necessarily see a sort of an explicit flaw, but we're certainly not targeting some a particular rating as a flaw for us, for our consideration. What we consider is that our overall cost of capital assessment and the overall regime that we're providing, and particularly important in this, is the ring fencing arrangements, which provide substantial protection to lenders. And seeing that in the round, we consider that a good solid investment grade rating is appropriate for the industry.
And then can I just ask a final question on that? And this relates to the fast money concept. I know some of the rating agencies try and look through fast money as a sort of gimmick, really, to window dress financials in the short term, which is, I guess, kind of what it is. But I guess, is it still a concept that you're fully comfortable with?
Yeah.
Given, obviously, everyone can interpret this type of mechanism in a different way, but obviously these ultimately eating into the growth profile of RAB in the longer term, so it has some negative credit consequences as well as equity consequences. I just want to understand, Ofgem's sort of comfort on the mechanism, I guess looking at longer term particularly.
Yeah. The great thing about fast money is that it does actually generate cash. And other things being equal, that cash can be used to reduce debt as well. So I think it's flawed thinking to see it as negative for the credit position of a company going forward. It is a clearly, if we were to go the whole hog and have a considerable amount of fast money, we'd be in a position where we'd have practically no debt at all, masses of cash swirling around, and there would be absolutely no financeability problems at all. So, and certainly our analysis of the effect of the reduction in the capitalisation rate, which creates more fast money for ENW, was that in the short term it has beneficial effects in terms of cash flows, but in the longer run also it actually positively facilitates a longer-term better credit profile for that company.
I think the other thing to note is not on the change in ENW's capitalisation rate is it's still within the the range that the rest of the industry is at. It's not kind of taking it outside that kind of norm. Any other questions?
As a reminder, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We have another follow-up question from Jamie Tunnicliffe from Redburn. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello again. I just wanted to check, just looking at the RORE ranges between the draft and the final, it looks as though they really haven't changed. I just wanted to check that was fair. So essentially, the main thing here is that there's a little bit more spend, a fair bit of that goes into the RAB, and the range on equity that can be achieved is very similar to what you were saying it was in July. Is that a fair sort of recap? Thank you.
I think that's a fair recap. I mean, as I said at the beginning, actually, overall, generally, not much has changed. So perhaps not surprising then that when you look at it pulled together in RORE terms, there's not much change either.
Thank you.
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay, well, thank you all very much. Clearly, if people do have any further questions that occur to them after this call, Brenda and my colleagues in Investor Relations would be very happy to pick those up and pass them on to us. Otherwise, thank you very much.
Thank you. That will conclude today's conference call. Thank you for your participation, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.